morning is Frontier Insurance Company against Hitchcock.
Please, the court. My name is Steve Plopper. I represent three individual indemnitors under a general agreement of indemnity that was entered into in 1999. The district court, we feel, erred in five different distinct manners in its judgment, entered in amended judgment that it entered in 2011. They departed from a 2006 order issued by Judge John Tinder with the...
Counsel, your brief discusses that at length, and I must say I can't see the significance of it. The question when we get to the Court of Appeals is not whether the district court has properly followed the law of the case, but whether the district court is right. On your view, at best, we have two district judges who disagree. We have to decide which is right. It doesn't help us to harp on the fact that two district judges have disagreed.
Yes, sir. We believe that the district court, the interpretation of the 2011 order, which departed, again, from the 2006 order, is that they made an interpretation that the general agreement of indemnity is one of exoneration rather than one of reimbursement.
Can I cut through the language, though? There's a paragraph in the General Agreement on Indemnity, paragraph 3, that, among other things, includes the phrase, and before it may be required to make payment thereunder. So looking at that language, it's hard for me to understand why the district court is wrong when it says you might need to pay before the demand has been made, because it actually talks about before it may be required to make payment.
Your Honor, we believe that paragraphs 1 and 3 need to be read together. Paragraph 1
Unfortunately, the way you propose to read them together makes paragraph 3 the same as paragraph 1. It essentially makes it go away. And ordinarily, we understand contracts so that different clauses have different meanings. You want to take the language Judge Wood has quoted and just expunge it from the contract. But it's there. We need to give it some meaning, not make it go away.
Your Honor, in all due respect, the district court ignored...
I don't think you want to keep using that phrase.
Yes, sir.
The phrase all due respect usually means, if you weren't a judge, I'd be using a rude word.
We hope that's not what you mean, of course, but but we have a real problem here, because that language that I quoted and to which the chief judge referred is there in the contract, and it's perfectly reasonable in these situations where, you know, you look at the overall transaction with the buyer's buyout bond, and of course Frontier wants to be sure. It happens in letters of credit as well. It happens in all sorts of circumstances. They want to make sure they have the money before they have to indemnify what I like to think of as the Hitchcock parties or whatever. I can't stand it when we have all these general names. So they might want to know that you're good for it before they have to pay out, you know, $1 million plus, $1.2 or even more dollars. So it's a rational reading of the language from a business point of view. And I'm not sure what force you give that language, if not the force that the district court's final order in this case gave it.
Your Honor, we believe that the second part of paragraph 3, which is not separated by any punctuation, is just a continuation of one run-on sentence, which sets forth that the fact and amount of the indemnitor's liability, what they will eventually have to pay to Frontier, the fact of amount is to be established with this prima facie evidence. That is part and parcel of the same paragraph 3, a provision that was drafted by Frontier, and we certainly submit should be construed in our favor, if construed at all.
Well, I'm perfectly happy not to give them an A-plus in English grammar. You know, they aren't the only contract drafters I would say that about. But giving prima facie effect to actual payment is somewhat different from talking about the timing of when money might be required to pass over as support for such a payment. And particularly here, I mean, the district judge didn't even require you to pay it to Frontier. The district judge said, you know, to make sure it's not dissipated or anything or used for the wrong purpose, it'll go into the registry of the court. So there's an extra safeguard. And, I mean, it's not that we don't understand why your clients don't want to part with their money for the time being. That's a rational thing, too. But if that's what the indemnity agreement requires, then that's what they have to do.
We believe the second part of paragraph 3 is speaking directly to the undersigned, meaning the indemnitor's liability. Now, there was never a bargain
struck. It's
just
evidence of the undersigned's, the indemnitor's liability. I mean, one of them is talking about proof of the fact and amount of the liability, and the other is kind of a preliminary step. Now, if the liability is less, they'll have to return the money.
But
right?
The liability of the undersigned, there was never a bargain struck to deposit a speculative amount. The undersigned's liability, which requires proof, some prima facie evidence, that liability is, we would submit that the undersigned or the indemnitors should not have to deposit something that's going to be considerably more than what their liability is ever going to turn out to be.
The indemnitor's liability is the full amount they owe to the buyers.
That's correct.
So if the deposit isn't completely dispersed through Frontier, it can be paid directly to the buyers. Your clients are basically trying to weasel out of an obligation freely undertaken, trying to weasel out of the obligation both to the insurance company and to the buyers of the stock. This is not a position we should be abetting.
That is not correct, Your Honor.
Well,
we
you
believe
should
that
precede that with all due respect, but go ahead.
I learned that lesson, Your Honor.
But we know what you're
in this instance, we made a contract with Frontier. We did not make a contract with who's in this litigation termed the Spencers.
No, we understand that, but let me just say, I think the thing that complicates this, which we actually, I believe, have to back out of in order to analyze the case properly, is the fact that the company is in, quote, rehabilitation, which is what makes you, for all I know, accurately predict that at the end of the day, the amount of money might change because of the enforceability of obligations and the fact that Frontier just might not have the money to do all of this. But typically in bankruptcy, which is similar to rehabilitation, you figure out what the obligations are as if there were no bankruptcy, and then it's up to the bankruptcy court to decide how many cents in the dollar wind up getting paid. And I think that that's what's happened in this South Carolina litigation. The total amount has been ascertained, and that was holding things up for quite a while in terms of the district court orders. And now that it's been ascertained, the question is, how much money is the court going to hang on to? How much money might be returned if the New York court decides that something less than that is going to turn over?
Your Honor, the general agreement of indemnity was not a part of the South Carolina litigation.
I know that, but it is. But it does.
That is a judgment amount against Frontier that will have to go into the rehabilitation court to be collected.
Right.
Our liability, our eventual liability to Frontier, is going to be determined by what goes on in the rehabilitation court, not
well,
what happened
where,
in South Carolina.
I think you're putting your finger on what the dispute is here, because actually, had there been no rehabilitation proceeding at all, your liability would be what Frontier has to pay over to the Spencers.
That's correct.
And
we certainly admit to that liability. But that liability has not been established as yet.
But it could be up to 100 cents on the dollar.
Could be up to 100 cents on the dollar, however.
Which is why this before it may be required to make payment there under language is important.
However, the fact of the rehabilitation cannot be escaped in this case. And the fact of the rehabilitation is that it's gone on for 11 years and now is proceeding to a liquidation. So the amount is soon to be determined as to what gets paid out on this particular surety bond. That amount is on September 28th.
But you don't dispute, do you, that if, let's say, if your clients were required to pay $1.5 million into the court registry and in the end only $500,000 is paid out in the bond, they'll get the other million back?
In theory. If that money is on deposit,
I realize the federal government's in trouble, but the court's not good for it.
One of our concerns, Your Honor, is that that money, if it's on deposit, is going to be subject to collateral attack. Two different times, the Spencers have tried to intervene in this litigation. Two times, they have been rejected.
I suppose that's the real definition of collateral attack.
You're right. That's correct, Your Honor. I see my time is up, so thank you very much.
Mr. Clover? Mr. Roma.
May it please the court, Mr. Flopper. What we have here is a situation that occurs in indemnity agreements, surety contracts on a regular basis. The surety signs an agreement to a third party, the obligees, the Spencers in this case, agreeing to essentially guarantee an obligation that the Hitchcock parties or the company that the Hitchcock parties were part of had owed to the Spencers. In order to do that, and in order to prevent the possibility that the surety may be sued and may even have a judgment entered against them, and in the meantime, the Hitchcock parties are dissipating their assets, they generally require language that says, we can demand that you make a deposit with us for us to hold as security in case we have to pay a loss.
Is there any temporal or specificity limit in your view on that? Could you require that the day the indemnity agreement is signed, or do you need to have some sense of the amount?
I think, Your Honor, that there is, as with all contracts, and I believe that Indiana has the same implication, but I believe that there is a duty to exercise good faith in making that demand, that we can't simply turn around and say, gee, at some point years in the future, you may default on your obligation and we may get sued, and therefore we want the collateral up front. You know, we could, of course, write a contract that requires that full collateral be provided before the surety bond was issued. I'll grant you that was not done in this case. But I believe that there has to be some obligation of good faith when that demand is made. In this case, the good faith was shown. The demand for collateral was not even made to the Hitchcock parties until after a suit had been filed in South Carolina, had proceeded for some period of time, in which the Spencers had alleged that there was a default by the principal on the bond and that they were seeking essentially the full amount of the bond together with interest and attorney's fees.
So why do you need the full amount if you're in the midst of these rehabilitation proceedings and this is turning into a fictional number?
Your Honor, as you indicated in your questioning to Mr. Plopper, there is a possibility that rehabilitation, or if it gets turned into a liquidation, that there would be 100% payout on the obligations, on the surety obligations.
Is that because of rules of priority, or what? It sounds like Mr. Plopper, anyway, said this is moving into liquidation, which suggests a shortage of funds.
And I will concede, Your Honor, that there is a pending request by the rehabilitator to move this into liquidation. The problem that we have is that, as the court recognized, this money is being paid pursuant to Judge Barker's ruling, which was then echoed by Judge Walton Pratt. The court is, or the funds are being held by the registry of the court.
Are they there right now?
They are not.
They're not. Okay.
They are not. There has been no deposit of any amount with the clerk of the court yet. If those funds are used to pay any portion of an amount that Frontier pays to the Spencers, then those would be properly removed from the registry of the court and reimbursed to Frontier. If those funds are not used for that purpose, the funds would be returned to the Hitchcock parties. What we have is two separate obligations. We have an indemnity obligation, which the Hitchcock parties have never argued that no indemnity obligation exists. And we have a deposit obligation. The indemnity obligation arises when a payment is made by Frontier. We don't contest that. The deposit obligation is a separate obligation that arises pursuant to the specific language of the indemnity agreement upon written demand from Frontier and before it may be required to make any payment. The Hitchcock parties have latched on to the second half of paragraph 3 and say this creates a condition precedent that Frontier must have made payment before they can demand a deposit. We would submit that the second half of paragraph 3 simply sets a standard by which Frontier can prove that it was allowed to properly use funds that were deposited. There are two steps in the process. The deposit is made, and then Frontier uses funds that are deposited with it in order to make payment of liabilities that Frontier has. The Hitchcock parties would have the right to challenge whether or not Frontier made those payments, whether or not they in fact made those payments, and whether or not they made those payments in good faith. The prima facie language contained in paragraph 3 is an evidentiary tool that allows Frontier to lessen the burden of proving that it made the payments and that the payments were made in good faith. So the prima facie language doesn't tie into whether or not the defendants are or whether or not the Hitchcock parties are required to make a deposit. Instead, they tie into whether or not payments from funds deposited were properly used by Frontier. That's the only reading of paragraph 3 that harmonizes the entire general agreement of indemnity and gives effect to all of the language of the general agreement. The Hitchcock parties would have the court just absolutely ignore the language that says before it may be required to make payment. And
I guess one of their arguments is that if this is such a muddle, why shouldn't we construe it against you and give them, in this sense, the benefit of the doubt?
If there were a reasonable interpretation that they could make that gave effect to all of the language of the agreement, then I could see where the court would have the right to construe the agreement against Frontier. Yeah, we will acknowledge this was as the Indiana courts have determined, this was an adhesion contract. It was given to them in a take it or leave it. You know, this is what you need to sign in order to get the bond. It was drafted by Frontier. But what the Hitchcock defendants have proposed is not a reasonable interpretation of the agreement. It ignores the language before any payment shall be required. The only reasonable interpretation is one that says you've got to make a deposit, and then the prima facie language applies to determine whether or not payments made by Frontier to satisfy Frontier's liability have in fact been made and have been made properly.
So let me ask you this. This may be impossible for you to answer, but anyway, I can certainly see how the Hitchcock parties may feel less than enthusiastic about paying a sum of money like this into the court's registry if this rehabilitation proceeding is going to drag on for another decade. Is there any timetable or anything to suggest when it might be wrapped up?
Your Honor, all I can say is I do know that there is a petition to convert the rehabilitation into a liquidation.
Then would that speed it up if that happened?
I am not well-versed in New York liquidation law.
So some other counsel is representing Frontier for that purpose?
Counsel up in New York.
Okay.
Is representing Frontier on that purpose. I can advise the court that the show cause hearing on whether or not it should be converted to liquidation is set for later this month, for the 28th of this month.
So, again,
we would argue that the only interpretation of the agreement that harmonizes all of the terms of the agreement is one that requires a deposit on demand and before payment is made, and then uses the prima facie language to determine whether or not payments from that deposit to the Spencer parties have been properly made. With regard to the amount that was determined, we would suggest that the court that in this instance the court reviews that matter on an abuse of discretion. That the amount that was awarded or the amount that was set by Judge Walton Pratt as the amount to be deposited was the amount that was established by the South Carolina court some 3 or 4 years earlier. It does not take into account any interest that has accrued since the entry of that South Carolina judgment. It relies on the South Carolina court to have addressed all of the arguments with regard to defenses against the surety bond. And we contend that Judge Walton Pratt properly used her discretion in setting the amount. Your Honor, I have no further information unless the court has any questions.
Seems not. Thank you, Mr. Roma.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Plopper?
Just briefly, in looking at Mr. Roma stated that their interpretation harmonizes the entire agreement. We think it does just the opposite. We think it ignores the reimbursement obligations that are established in paragraph 1. There's been a demand for reimbursement or indemnification from Frontier that occurred back in 2004. The indemnitors met that obligation by assuming the defense and paying the attorneys for Frontier. That's the only demand for indemnification that they have ever made. They turned strictly to a demand for deposit rather than the demand for indemnification subsequent to that time. If you look at paragraph 3, it's the conjunction and ties the first part, which is the requirement to make a deposit before payment, and that the voucher or any other evidence of payment by the company of such loss, damage, cost, and expense shall be the prima facie evidence. It is.
But just to unwind this, though, I mean, the beginning predicates have all happened. So the Spencers, I guess maybe when CT folded or something, but the Spencers said, we want our money for the stock that we sold to you or for the company or whatever. And that's what the South Carolina litigation was all about, because they couldn't turn to CT for it, so they go to Frontier for the money. Frontier has this judgment against it in the South Carolina case. It's just what begins to trigger all the rest of these provisions.
But their procedure, they had a choice. I guess they had a choice. They decided to proceed to South Carolina, even though surety claims were being adjudicated within the rehabilitation in all of these intervening 11 years. They chose to go to South Carolina. South Carolina court itself says to collect, you're going to have to go back to New York. Our point is that it is the loss suffered by Frontier that we agreed was our basic bargain, that we agreed to indemnify. We're not trying to shirk that duty, but that loss has to be established before our obligation kicks in. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. Our third case for argument today.